In 1378, the church found itself with two popes, one in Rome and one in France.
In short order, all of Europe is excommunicated by one pope or the other. Am I receiving true sacraments? Am I in fellowship with the true pope? How am I supposed to know? Who is the true pope?
History shows us that there was no bigger question in the medieval world than how much authority should the pope have. You're listening to the Saturday edition of Renewing Your Mind. I'm Lee Webb. Each week, we present a lesson from Dr. W. Robert Godfrey's series, A Survey of Church History. Dr. Godfrey is President Emeritus of Westminster Seminary, California. He's also a Ligonier Teaching Fellow and a respected church historian. We have progressed from the apostolic era through the early church, and now we've reached the Middle Ages. In the 13th and 14th centuries, the church faced unique challenges. Rival popes and ecumenical councils attempted to assume power in the church. So let's join Dr. Godfrey now for today's lesson.
We're now in our third section of our threefold division of the Middle Ages, the working it out part. And one of the important things we want to look at is inside the church, and particularly inside the papacy, how the implications of the kinds of claims that Innocent III made for the papacy got worked out in the life of the church. Because even though Innocent III had made what we might call strong rhetorical statements for himself, ruler of the world, father of princes and kings, that had never been fully articulated or worked out. And the exact claims, the exact character of the papacy was still an issue under some debate. And what I want to focus on today is some of the reflection on the papacy that went on, and then the great crisis of the papacy in this third part of the Middle Ages. The sort of high point of claims for the papacy came in the pontificate of Pope Boniface VIII. It was Boniface VIII who was pope from 1284 to 1303. Boniface VIII said, "All authority on earth, spiritual and temporal, derives from me." So nowhere on earth can you find any authority, either spiritual authority or civil authority, except that it comes from me. This is an astounding claim. Now really articulated, Boniface VIII writes a bull in which he makes this claim, the Unum Sanctum. The one holy church is the next word, and he's the head. The church is the head of everything. This is of course, another episode in this struggle between emperor and pope. Who's really in charge? These are the most exalted claims of the papacy. Boniface VIII, in fact, didn't have probably anything like the actual power that Innocent III did, but the claims go on, and the claims are important. In the church as a broader truth, however, there are discussions going on, somewhat abstract questions most of the time. What is the exact character of papal power? And canon lawyers were discussing this. There was this whole developed law structure governing the life of the church. That's what canon law is, the law for the life of the church. And canon lawyers knew that in the history of the church, there had sometimes been two claimants for the papal throne. Sometimes an emperor would depose a pope and name another pope, and you'd have two popes. And the lawyers began to wrestle with this question: how do you figure out who's really pope? Could a pope ever be removed from office? If so, who would have the authority to remove him? And you get two streams of thought amongst the canon lawyers, some of whom assert what we might call absolute monarchy of the pope. The pope is an absolute monarch. No one can judge him. No one can criticize him. No one could remove him. Only God can remove a pope. And on the other side, there's a tradition of canon law that we might call limited monarchy that says, no, the pope is not absolute. If a pope became a heretic, what would we do? And even the absolutist said, well, he would be automatically self-removed by becoming a heretic. But of course, who's going to decide he's a heretic? And so there's tension, some of it fairly abstract. You know how lawyers can be, talking about cases that haven't come up yet, but trying to think, how would the law apply if it ever came up? Well, then it did come up. It came up really. And it came up as a result of what first began in 1309, right after, or almost immediately after, the pontificate of Boniface, when a Frenchman was elected pope in 1309, Pope Clement V, and decided he didn't like conditions in Rome. There was all these political haggling and these wealthy families and all of this trouble, so he moved to Avignon in France. He moved the papacy to France. Now, this was sort of traumatic. It wasn't obvious that the pope couldn't live in another place, but after all, he's pope because he's bishop of Rome. So you'd think there's a certain obligation for a connection to Rome. Now, they were used to many bishops not living in their diocese, but this notion of the pope leaving was troubling for many people. And so this period in the history of the Middle Ages comes to be known as the Babylonian captivity of the church, because the pope was gone for about 70 years, just like the Babylonian captivity, you see. So from 1309 to 1377, not quite 70 years, the papacy was in the French town of Avignon. Now, this was traumatic, but not terrible for the church. It was distressing, it was problematic, but it wasn't in any way sort of fatal for the life of the church. There was still a pope, he was still in charge, but there were constant appeals that the papacy should return. And so an aging Pope Gregory XI in 1377 moved back from Avignon to Rome and then died. 1378, a new pope was elected, and the French cardinals didn't like this new pope. For 70 years, the French cardinals had been sort of able to run things. They'd been up in France, the wine was better, the climate was better, everything was better in France, as any Frenchman will tell you, and they didn't really like being back in Rome, and now this Roman pope has been elected, he's not a Frenchman, things are going from bad to worse. So the French cardinals withdrew and elected a Frenchman as pope and moved back to Avignon. And Europe now finds itself in 1378 with two popes, a Roman pope and an Avignese pope. And Europe rapidly begins to take sides. This becomes very politicized. And pretty soon, all of the great monarchs and noblemen of Europe have chosen sides. They're with one pope or the other. And the minute anybody lined up with one pope, the other excommunicated them. And so, in short order, all of Europe is excommunicated by one pope or the other. And this becomes a big deal, because once again, the whole question of sacraments, vital for my connection to God, my personal salvation, is at risk. Am I receiving true sacraments? Am I in fellowship with the true pope? How am I supposed to know? Who is the true pope? Well, you know the answer to that in history. The true pope is the winner. But when you're living through it, you don't know who the winner is going to be. And this was a very spiritually traumatic time for Europe, and neither of these two popes would give an inch. So the canon lawyers were set to work. What are we supposed to do in a situation like this? How are we going to solve this? This is a great crisis for the church. Well, it went on for some time, but Europe was deeply distressed. And so by 1409, that means this has been going on 30 years, 1409, they finally decide the only way to settle this is by holding an ecumenical council. And in 1409, a council is summoned to meet in the Italian city of Pisa. And the great hope is that this council will bring pressure to bear on these two popes to resolve this problem. And at the Council of Pisa, 1409, the decision is made that the really good way forward is what they called the via cessionis, which is the way of resignation. Let's get both popes to resign, and we can elect a new pope, and everybody will be happy. Well, it sounded kind of sensible, the way, you know, sensible proposals are made to our Congress, and there's always a sensible reaction, right? Well, somebody might have been able to predict this. Both popes refused to resign, and so the council says the only way we can resolve this is to depose both popes. Well, kick them both out, and we'll elect a new pope, which they did. Except that left Europe with three popes. So now you had a Roman pope, you had an Avignese pope, and you had a Pisan pope. Who's the real pope? This was a duly called ecumenical council. How could you deny it the right to depose a pope and to elect a pope? Unless you're a papal absolutist and say, no council can challenge a pope. So now you see, we are seeing an evolution in papal politics, interestingly parallel to the evolution that will take place later in European civil politics. Later, the issue will be, for example, in England, is the monarch an absolute monarch, or is the monarch limited by the parliament? What right does the parliament have vis-a-vis the monarch? And in England, this will lead to a civil war and the beheading of a king. Well, there's a kind of civil war going on in the church now in the 15th century. And finding themselves with three popes and not thinking this is a real improvement, the church decides to have yet another council. And another council is called the Council of Constance, which meets in the city of Constance on the German-Swiss border from 1414 to 1418. Some of us as Protestants remember that council because it's the council that orders the burning of John Huss. And Huss is burned in Constance. You can still visit the city of Constance and see the Hussstein, the stone on which John Huss was martyred. But the more important thing in terms of the contemporary life of the church, not more important to Huss, but more important to the rest of the church than his execution, was this question: what are we going to do? What are we going to do now that we have all these popes? And how are we going to move forward? Well, it was clear that the via cessionis hadn't worked, the way of resignation, or the way of deposing popes. This hadn't worked. This hadn't succeeded. And so something more radical is proposed at Constance. And what is proposed there is that the council should declare that it is the ultimate authority in the church. This becomes known as the via concilii, the way of the council. This council is going to say, not only is the pope not an absolute monarch in the life of the church, but we want to declare that the ultimate authority in the life of the church is the council. The pope is dependent on the council. The council may not meet all the time. Between council meetings, the pope is supreme in the life of the church. But this mess we're in with multiple papal claimants forces us to recognize that the papacy as an institution is not adequate in itself, and we want a declaration that it is the council that is supreme in the life of the church. And this was declared in a decree of the council that is known to history as Hic Sancta or Sacro Sancta. You know, all of these documents and decrees just take the first two words as the title. So often they're not very useful to translate as a title. This just means this holy, which doesn't tell you a whole lot. But the declaration in this document, 1417, is very important because it says the whole church is bound by the decisions of a council whose authority is directly from Christ. again, to use our parallel with English civil politics, this is the moment at which the parliament says it's superior to the king. This is the moment when the council says it's superior to the pope. And this is a really big deal. This is going to now regularize the life of the church and establish the authority of the council to govern in extremis. But as the council continues to meet, people get more and more attracted to this idea of the council functioning in the life of the church. And so in 1417, the council passes another decree called Frequens. And this title actually is somewhat helpful, because this decree deals with the question, how frequently should the council meet? And the Council of Constance declared that a council was to be called frequently by the pope to help in the governance of the church. I think the decree said every 10 years a pope should call a council to help with the government of the church. This is really radical. This is really getting to be very, very remarkable. The claims now of conciliarism, as the movement comes to be called, are really strict. And had this actually succeeded as a movement, would have changed the whole character of the Catholic Church in a most profound way. The council then proceeded to depose all three popes and to elect a new pope. This council seems to have succeeded. Most of Europe, just worn out by having three popes and trying to decide who to follow, accepted the pope elected by the council at Constance as the true pope, as the real pope. And eventually, the claims of the other popes receded, began to disappear from claim, and the life of the church then seemed to settle down, except that the pope felt he was bound by the decree of Frequens. And so in 1431, he calls another council. And this council meets way up north in Basel, the Swiss city. And the Council of Basel at least formally remains in session from 1431 till 1449. And it becomes even more radical than the Council of Constance and begins to assert its rights as a council in the government of the church and begins to assert and stress the dependence of the pope on the council. And now the pope is really getting nervous. Here you have this council way far north, so he can't control it very easily, a council which is getting more and more radical, more and more threatening the power of the papacy. What to do? How to respond? One of the things that the pope does is to order the council to move from Basel back to Italy, where it'll be closer, more in control, more able to be under papal supervision. And so now comes a critical issue before the Council of Basel. Do they have to obey the pope's order? Who's really in charge here? Are they able to determine for themselves where they'll meet, what they'll do? And guess what? The council splits. Part of it moves back to Italy, first in Ferrara and then later in Florence, and part of it remains in Basel. And the part that remains in Basel becomes more and more radical, more and more at war with the pope, until guess what happens? They depose the pope and elect a new one. And Europe says, wait a minute. The council was supposed to stop this from happening. And now the council's becoming the cause of this. And that overreach by Basel, I think, is part of what really ended conciliarism as a serious option in the minds of many Roman Catholics. Conciliarism suddenly was no longer the solution. It was part of the problem. And people said, we don't need two popes again. And so Basel continued to meet for a number of years, but became more and more irrelevant. Its pope never received a lot of support. And This was the moment at which the papacy was able to reassert itself, reassert its control over the council, and begin to get things done at the council that it wanted done. Some interesting things done once the council moved from, or the papal part of the council moved from Basel to Florence. They entered into negotiations with the Eastern Church to try to regain unity. They did that because Constantinople was holding on with white knuckles to survival. It would be only about a decade later that Constantinople would fall to the Turk. And the emperor was desperate in the East to try to get support from the West. And it appeared for a moment that the churches had been reunited at the Council of Florence. But then the Eastern Church didn't really want it, the West didn't really want it, and it fell apart. But for a moment, it looked like it might work. Another interesting thing that happened at the Council of Florence, for the first time, a council of the church officially declared that the church had seven sacraments. If you know anything about the Catholic Church, you know they talk all the time about the seven sacraments of the Catholic Church. That had never been officially declared until the Council of Constance in the 15th century, less than a century before Luther. Now, when you go back to Peter Lombard, centuries earlier, Lombard talked as if there were seven sacraments, but that was just one opinion. There were lots of other opinions. Well, maybe not lots, but there were other opinions floating around in the life of the church. So the Council of Florence was important for that as well. After these councils stopped their meeting, the papacy made clear that from now on, councils could only be called by the Pope and would be under the jurisdiction of the Pope, and their decrees would have binding authority only if the Pope approved their decrees. This was the great reaction of the papacy to establish itself as an absolute monarchy. And the papacy was successful in doing that. One of the popes of the 15th century said, "Anyone who appeals from a present papal decision to a future council is shown to be a heretic by that action." So don't think you can get around me by talking about a future council. I'm in charge. Now that's important, because what does Martin Luther do in the 1520s? He says, "I appeal from the Pope to a future council." Luther, in part, was trying to revive this spirit of conciliarism to limit papal authority in the church. It didn't work, and the church split in two. But you see how important this conciliar movement is as a reflection of the struggle of the medieval church to figure out exactly what is the role of the Pope? Exactly how much authority does he have? Is he an absolute monarch or a limited monarch? For a moment it looked like he might be a limited monarch, but he was able to reassert himself and again establish really what we could say are distinctive elements of the Roman Catholic Church, not really ancient, but established only in relatively recent times.
We see in these skirmishes within the church, don't we, why a young Martin Luther became dissatisfied, why he took the stand that he did. The popes made bold claims about their authority, but the way they exercised that authority was questionable. We've continued Dr. Robert Gottfried's series, A Survey of Church History, here on Renewing Your Mind. This look at the growth of the church from the apostolic era to the modern age is covered in 73 lessons. Dr. Gottfried taught this series over the course of 4 years here on the campus of Ligonier Ministries, and we'd like to provide you the entire set, 12 DVDs in all, for your gift of any amount today. Make your request at renewingyourmind.org or call us at 800-435-4343. You know, when we understand where we've come from, we can better know where we're going. So knowing church history is an important piece of our theological education. If you teach a Sunday school class or lead a small group, or if you homeschool, this series will be a great benefit. For your gift of any amount, we'll be glad to send it your way, 73 lessons on 12 DVDs. Again, our phone number is 800-435-4343, and our web address is renewingyourmind.org. Theological education is the reason Ligonier Ministries exists. Dr. Sproul says his desire for this ministry is to bridge the gap between Sunday school and seminary. To that end, we provide teaching series on this daily Renewing Your Mind program, as well as through RefNet, our 24-hour internet radio station. There you'll find not only the teaching of Dr. Sproul, but many others like Albert Mohler, Stephen Lawson, John MacArthur, and Alistair Begg, just to name a few. You can begin listening to RefNet online at refnet.fm, or you can download the free app and begin listening on the go. Again, the website is refnet.fm. Well, next weekend, Dr. Godfrey takes a look at the scholastics of the 13th and 14th centuries. Europe began to establish its first universities, and the thinkers who appeared there dramatically shaped Christian thought. We hope you'll join us next Saturday for Renewing Your Mind.